The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for July 13th, 2017, the I Love It edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. We are all together again. That means a lineup, a diet of John Dickerson of Face the Nation. Howdy, John.
Hello, David.
And Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily. Still in Washington.
Yay.
How is it being in the swamp?
It got hot this week, but I'm really happy to be here. I've been having a great time.
That's great.
Yeah.
I'm so glad. Yeah. How's my parents' house?
Your parents' house is lovely. It's cool. It's peaceful. The backyard is nice. We've been having a lovely time at your parents' house.
That's great.
Thank you to your parents.
Yay. On this week's Gabfest, Donald Trump Jr., a chip off the old block, and the snowballing story of his mysterious Russian meetings. Then, is this finally the final chapter in the Obamacare repeal drama? As the Senate gets to its last moments with this bill, is this our Deathly Hallows, our Return of the Jedi with healthcare? I don't know. Probably not. No doubt we'll be talking about it forever. Then the New York Times' Mark Leibovich drops by for a visit to talk about the state of Washington, of the state of this town in the age of Trump. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. It is about 10 o'clock in the morning as we're taping on Thursday. So whatever stunning revelation is coming today about Trump family ties to Russia or collusion or desirous collusion or what was your collusion curious, John's great phrase about it. Whatever is coming today has not yet occurred. Every day this week has brought us astonishing news about Russian meddling in the election and the Trump campaign's eagerness to embrace it. The central figure in this cancer of a story is Donald Trump Jr., the scion of the president, born on third base, thought he hit a home run. By now, you have all heard the story that Junior received an email missive from the ridiculous Rob Goldstone proposing a meeting with a Russian, promising dirt on Hillary Clinton and referring to the Russian campaign, to a Russian campaign to help Trump get elected. Trump Junior, of course, responded, "I love it." And a meeting ensued between the Kremlin-tied Russian lawyer named Natalia Veselitz. Can you guys pronounce it? You must have had to say it on television, John.
Not yet.
No. And I'm going to
Veselitzkaya,
as well as Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort. We should also keep in mind, of course, that Trump and Trump Jr. and everybody else has lied and lied and lied repeatedly about whether they had any Russian contacts, lied on federal forms, lied to the FBI about it. Now, when it is clear they did have Russian contacts, they lied about what the contacts consisted of. So how bad is this story for President Trump, John?
I mean, it's bad. It's a distraction. It undermines his ability to say there's no proof of collusion, although we should talk about it's obvious that the president's son was thrilled about the idea of collusion. What this doesn't to me prove is that actually collusion happened. Collusion, in the way we've been talking about it, means an ongoing effort to work in concert with the Russians to get Donald Trump elected. That's different than what happened at this meeting or what we know happened after the meeting or anything like that. But anyway,
and that's important for not getting ahead of the facts.
Right. And yes. So his position still is, whether it's the truth or not, his position still is that he didn't know about this meeting. So we don't know.
Right. But we had nothing to do with Russia. My campaign, you know, Don Jr., this is Don Jr., not the president, but saying like, this is a disgusting allegation. There's a whole sort of set of rhetorical outrage that has now been completely punctured.
Absolutely. Right. And so it's a lot stickier for him, and who knows where this will lead.
Yes.
And if the bar is so low for a meeting where collusion with the Russian government is promised, then presumably in other instances, that since we know the Russians were in an ongoing, constant effort to destabilize the election to help Donald Trump, were there no other entry points of connection between the two? And if the bar was so low in this one entry point, it is not insane to think there might have been another instance where there might have. Now, none of that's been proved, but
I add one more thing to that I think is important, which is, why would Jared Kushner be secretly setting up a back channel with the Kremlin 5 months later if there was nothing in between? And again,
well,
this is
I have
just
the opposite
inference.
Reaction, actually.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, I'm like, if there was a collusion effort, why would they have such a shambolic caper as this promoter sending an email which then Don Jr. is excited to receive. Wouldn't there be existing setup channels for this collusion?
Ah, but that is fine as a premise for like the bumbling way in which this approach was made. But it doesn't, to me, suggest. And again, we're in the realm of like suggestion and inference. But the notion that between July and that Kushner back channel secret moment in December, I believe, there was nothing in between. I mean, I don't know. I just find that I'm skeptical.
I mean, certainly we've things that have been said didn't exist now do exist. Mm. So there's obviously the possibility that
and we also
again,
know there's other stuff. I mean, Michael Flynn stuff is all going on in between.
In between.
So
exactly. And we have this McClatchy story about how the Mueller investigation is looking into how Jared Kushner's data analytics potentially could have helped the Russians figure out how to target their social media anti-Hillary.
So hear that story.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Jesus. No, totally.
But I never got to my butt, which is that unlike the question of obstruction, where the president is the central actor in that drama, in this case, there is still no evidence that he was a part of this. There aren't any facts that put the president at the center of this drama. They have now put the drama closer to him in terms of the circles of his acquaintances. But in terms of the president's jeopardy, while it's obviously politically quite damaging, or it doesn't get closer to him in terms of, it seems to me, impeachment issues, which again, since impeachment is not legal, it's political. You don't have the president at the center in a way that's going to get, you know, Republicans to start bailing.
Well, I want to talk about that, Emily. So there's actually been surprisingly little response, I would say, to the story from Republicans generally. And I assume that this is, I think there's the, well, we're going to allow the Mueller investigation to continue, and that's what we're going to focus on. And that gives Congress, Republicans in Congress, a pass to have to do anything. But there is absolutely no evidence that there's any internal movement to abhor, to investigate, to condemn, to prevent the recurrence of this behavior. It's just they just are not dealing with it. Is there any, do you see any reason to think that Republicans in Congress are going to be moved by this? They have not been moved by anything so far, by the rampant corruption, by the incompetence, by all the other tremendous evidence of collaboration with our adversary.
No, I don't see any reason to think they'll be moved. And I have sort of two reactions to this. I mean, one is that if you think about the politics, it's pretty rational. If anything, they could see their window closing even sooner, right? So, you know, the rush to that, maybe this is the real reason they're not going out for their August recess. Like, yes, they want to pass this healthcare bill, but also they can see that, you know, already the time is ticking away. And if this is going to completely engulf the party and the government and the president, they better like pass something while they can. So there's that motivation. The other thing, though, that I keep going back to, and I mean, John, you know a lot more about this than me, but, you know, some of the Republicans in Congress have staked their career on protecting the country from foreign interference, especially from the Russians. I mean, back to the Cold War. And so the notion that they would stand by while potentially, you know, our longtime enemy and Vladimir Putin, an alarming world figure, is literally potentially infiltrating the presidency and the government. I understand that the base has not fled from Trump, but I find it like shocking, just deeply shocking. I'm going to retain my right to be shocked about that because it is crazy. And if you imagine what would be happening if President Obama or Hillary Clinton had anything like
this. 1/20th of this, 1/100th of it.
It's just, I just find it jaw-dropping.
The previous standard was that to even suggest that anybody in the Trump campaign was in conversation with Russians trying to meddle in the election was an abhorrent smear. Kellyanne Conway suggested that when I asked her about it. The vice president did as well. Even the president's son, was when I asked about it by Jake Tapper on CNN, suggested that even to hint at the idea there was any conversation was a calumny that shouldn't even be uttered by responsible members of the press. And now one of the defenses is essentially, hey, nothing happened. So he got an email, you know, no big deal. But if you just focus on the response to the email, which is, I love it, and then let's go have a meeting with people claiming to be from the Russian government offering information, by the previous standard, by the reactions when asked about it over the last many months, by that standard, this was, you know, a grave act.
But if the American public or the representatives who represent them from the Republican Party will not make a consequence of that, will not hold that president to account, will not, you know, say that this is a serious issue, it doesn't matter. It's incredible.
And that's frightening.
And John, you didn't really answer Emily's point, which is you have this these people in Congress who have made such a big deal about these issues in the past and who have so abandoned it. And it well, is, and you have John McCain who'll say things, you know, he'll say a word
Graham.
Or two. Or,
right.
Oh, I think,
and, but that's,
people.
But there's no active effort. And maybe they're like, well, Mueller's investigating and we'll just let Mueller do it.
I think they're
but
too.
But they can't be like that because Congress also has to investigate. Sorry, John.
But they, so, but, well, they don't want to.
There is a sanctions package that voted overwhelmingly out
that
of the
Senate. Not, that has nothing to do with it. That
and
punishes Russia. That does not punish the wrong actions of Americans.
So hold on just a step back. So if the claim is, what do these senators do who care so much about Russia? So that's the answer. The senators who care about Russia and Russia's threat to America and the threat as it was demonstrated in the last election by interfering in the election, they have, in fact, passed legislation designed to punish Russia for that thing.
Which and is still not law because it is stuck in the House.
One of the things that's really interesting, though, about and the biggest development, if you care about Russia and the United States and its relationship with that adversary slash enemy, is the meeting that the president had with Vladimir Putin and the disclosure over the weekend, seemingly by the president, that he wants to basically move on so that the Russians will pay no penalty for interfering in the election. And the reason that's important is there are a number of people, including former candidate Donald Trump and his Secretary of State, who argue that if you show weakness towards Russia when they do something, if you don't punish them, that they then are invited to go do more things. This has excited the passions of those people in the Republican Party who are worried about Russia. And they then ridiculed essentially the president when the president announced as one of the great achievements of the meeting with Vladimir Putin that they had this joint cyber unit. I mean, when Marco Rubio, who is a pretty risk-averse politician, is saying that a joint cyber unit with the Russians is like a joint chemical weapons unit with Assad, that's a pretty universal condemnation of an idea, again, but related to those Republicans who Emily was talking about earlier, who are not fans of Russia and where do they behave. So that's a place where they can react and not have to get into having to jump on Donald Trump.
But it's so easy to react. I could react. I mean, we can all react to Russia. I mean, who it's as easy as pie to react to Russia.
That's, yeah,
there's
no,
that's
what's the
more
for
me. I don't
why are they so incredibly unwilling to look at this that's clearly abhorrent, reprehensible, possibly illegal, certainly unethical and wrongheaded behavior.
Also, can
and
I add one
and
more
and stand up?
But the idea
it?
But the idea of the claim was that they're not living up to their previous standard of being tough on Russia. So if the claim is they're not being tough on Russia, then
no,
the
not
fact that
just tough on Russia.
Well, then
also
that's a
about
claim.
The United States and how we protect our democracy and our right to have our own free and independent government from interference.
But that's why they voted to impose sanctions on the country that was perpetrated.
I mean, you're talking about a half-passed bill. That's it.
Well,
like,
the senators can't pass a bill through the House.
These are people.
What else would you have them do? Go on cable TV and wag their
John,
finger? What's more useful?
You don't think
passing,
these people have any?
This is a party.
No,
this is a party that spent
to,
most of that
I'm
spent most of the 20th century rooting out. Communism and rooting out Americans who they perceive to be siding with an enemy, with an adversary.
What thing would you have them do that is more substantial than passing sanctions that would actually punish the Russians and that the Russians don't want?
I think the congressional.
What would you actually have them
the
do?
The Senate Investigative Committee, Senator Burr's committee, they need to be saying this is the moment when we really get to the bottom of this. We make what we know public. We drag all these people out here. Like, we're ramping
like
it
who?
Up. We're taking, like, all of them, like Don
who?
Jr.
They've
like
asked Don Jr. to.
But
to,
do you, Jared Kushner, these people,
I
this
think
should all.
Asked Kushner.
They have asked him, but it all is happening kind of slowly and sedately. There is no sense of urgency or anything like approaching like a five alarm
fire
still, going
by the
on
way,
right now.
Which is more punish? Which punishes the Russians more? Sanctions or having Jared Kushner testify?
But you are assuming that. Punishing the Russians is the only thing on the table, and
but
I just
you guys
think that's
are saying
bullshit.
The entire standard of the question in the debate has been these guys are total hypocrites
because
they've hated Russia and now they're not.
Because it's also about protecting the United States.
Well, go back and listen.
No,
protecting the United States against who?
But protecting
Jared
the United
Kushner?
States
no,
yes,
against,
yes,
potentially
against Americans
against
who,
people
Americans who are betraying the country and undermining democracy and undermining the electoral system. Absolutely.
If nothing else, we know now how vulnerable these people were to blackmail. Also, I got to add one more fact to this because I really think this is important. The president of the United States said to the AP or Reuters yesterday, I think a lot of people would have taken that meeting. I mean, that is like on the basis of that email, the part of the Russian government's effort to like that is creeping up to the idea that collusion with Russia or at least the potential of going down that road is acceptable conduct for someone who is running for president. That is something that Republicans like they are very good at reacting slash overreacting to allegations like that, to intimations like that when they feel like it. Instead, we're seeing like this incredibly flabby, quiet nothing. Like, so, this is the nothing burger of the week.
So that point I totally agree with. So the speed with which Jared Kushner is or, you know, is going to testify doesn't do much for me. But at this moment, when somebody is trying to suggest a new norm about what happens in campaigns, particularly on this question of what happens with respect to respect to the Russians, who the previous nominee of the party said was America's number one geopolitical foe, to suggest that that an email that comes and says the Russian government is trying to help your father and we've got dirt, that just accepting that and saying, oh, yeah, sure, I'll take that meeting is normal. It is the responsibility of people to say, no, that's not normal, because while many, many, many things have been done in campaigns that are underhanded, I mean, Richard Nixon working with the South and North Vietnamese to slow down the peace talks so that Humphrey wouldn't win is pretty grim in terms of the kinds of things that have happened in campaigns. But there have been instances. Tom Downey, when he got what was supposed to be the briefing book from the Bush campaign in 2000, handed it over immediately to the FBI and recused himself from debate stuff when he worked for Gore. Goldwater chose not to go after Walter Jenkins when he was arrested for a lewd act in a YMCA bathroom. McCain restrained a lot of things about Obama's race that were brought to him by people wanting to take on to Obama. Dean Rusk, in a quote that I just found in the 1968 race, they're talking about these wiretaps they have showing that Nixon was trying to slow down the talks in order to hurt Humphrey. And Rusk said, Mr. President, I have a very definite view on this. This is about whether to use the wiretaps to hurt Nixon. I do not believe that any president can make any use of interceptions or telephone taps in any way that would involve politics. The moment we cross over that divide, we are in a different kind of society. That was on a taped phone conversation with Johnson, and they decided not to use the wiretaps to hurt Nixon.
Well, I'm really glad you brought all of that up, because also now we're back on the same page. And I am going to bring up a law in addition to all the norms we're worried about, which is the foreign solicitation ban. So we have this law on the books. It's illegal to ask a foreigner for a contribution. Giving anything of value, and that can be goods and services as well as money, is a contribution. And so asking a foreigner to give goods or services to a campaign below value is illegal. I have stolen all of that from Adav Noti on Twitter. But look, that is a really broad law. And I've been thinking this week about whether it's overbroad. And Eugene Volokh, a law professor at UCLA, I think, argued that it violates the First Amendment because it's such a broad prohibition. But the reason we have this broad law is that we want to make sure that our elections are free from foreign influence. There is no reason to think that other countries are on our side in making sure that we remain free and independent and have fair and free elections. That's just not something we can assume. And that is what's at stake here. I'm not sure that anyone broke this law. Like, this is where we don't want to get ahead of the facts. But the fact that we've constructed these rules to be so broad is indicative of what's at stake.
I want to make two final points. One is, John, I think you are vastly underplaying the responsibility of the legislature of the United States to
pass sanctions legislation.
No. To ensure that our elections are free and fair and not disrupted, and that Americans themselves are not getting into bed with people seeking to undermine the very foundation of democracy. I don't know if there's a crime committed, but I don't think it's enough for John McCain and Lindsey Graham to mutter a couple of vaguely condemnatory phrases every now and then. I think there does have to be actual interrogative action by Congress and actual intent by Congress. So that's the first point I would make. The second point I want to make is, at the same time, I also think that Democrats and liberals are awfully premature in their celebrations and their glee. And there's been this kind of Twitter delight in declarations of victory in the last few days, which I think are so misguided.
Be more specific. Victory about what?
Well, it's just like this. There's a sense like, well, it's game, set, and match.
Done.
We've got it. Now we've mailed it. Like, we've found evidence of collusion, or the basically a smoking gun of collusion. It's just, you know, now it's just a matter of getting some prosecutions done, and this presidency is over.
Yeah,
this presidency does not end because we find collusion with Russia. This presidency has so many other dangerous things going on, and it's going to persist. And like, the Democrats are in such a better position when they argue on issues, particularly around health care, around taxes, and to spend as much mental energy as they're spending on this issue, I think, is going to be a mistake for them.
Well, it's got to be both, right? I mean, you have to, in a like sober way, I think it's important for Democrats to pay attention to, like, not ignore it. But I completely agree with you, imagining that this is like, this email was a smoking gun of a sort that we rarely see. Let's give it its due. But it has not proven a crime. It's not directly tied to the president, as John was saying. And like, even with Nixon and Watergate, it took almost 2 years.
So if actions are more important than words, what kinds of actions can Congress actually take? So they can convene hearings and have committees do focus on one issue more than any other. So you've got the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee focusing on this question of Russian interference in the election above all other issues. Television networks are covering the hearings live. That gives you some sense of what Congress is doing. There are two committees, and the Intelligence Committee in both the House and the Senate. Then you got the Judiciary Committees in both the House and the Senate looking into this issue. And you've got the only piece of substantive piece of
John,
bipartisan legislation.
They,
hold on, wait a minute.
You know they
are
slow walking those committees.
Wait a minute,
you know it. You've been in Washington. You're a 49-year-old person. You've been in Washington all the time. For you to say that the Senate and House committees are engaged in a really vigorous attempt to ferret out the truth and very active is like, that is so disingenuous.
No. All I'm doing is trying to respond to the thing you actually
said. There's also Christopher Wray's nomination, the director of the FBI. Trump's choice for the FBI is about to get confirmed with like no fuss.
Hold on. Let's stop shifting the ground. Let's stay on the original ground.
That's something
of the,
they can do.
I understand.
They could do.
But that's a good point. No, that's a really good point. But let's go back to the previous ground, which is the David's claim that only a few words are being mumbled. So if that's true, then there would be no hearings. Now, the hearings may be slow walk. That is a totally new piece of ground. We can debate about that and just assume that you're relinquishing the original argument, which I assume you are, since you've shifted to the new ground.
Well,
so
no
you
one's
have,
relinquishing
oh,
any
oh,
ground
come on,
here.
John.
We're not
come on.
Relinquishing any ground.
The claim that all people have done is mumbled a few words is wrong on its face. You can say.
Do you think they're doing everything they could do?
That's
and
a different claim.
Be doing? Well,
that's
let's
a different
ask
claim.
That.
So now that's a new claim. Are they doing everything they should and could be doing? Okay. So your claim about the FBI director is perfectly right. So should he not get the job? That's a really interesting question. I don't know what the answer to that is. What would the grounds be for him not getting confirmed?
If you really were concerned, you could just say, let's hit the pause button on the FBI, that maybe this president, we don't want to get ahead of the facts, but we also are not sure we can trust his choice. And so this is an incredibly sensitive position. This is the person who is going to be overseeing the investigation of the campaign and of this Russian influence. And you know what? We're not going to confirm anyone right now.
Who oversees it now?
Andrew McCabe, who's the FBI interim director, who's a career guy. And like, as far as we know, it's happening. I mean, we are about to be in a position in which Bob Mueller and Rod Rosenstein are like standing between us and the end of having oversight over having an investigation into the president and his top people. That's it. If Trump decides to fire Mueller and Rosenstein either resigns or lets that happen, like that's
then
the game.
Then the new FBI director is
you
the only
think
other.
This guy who Trump just appointed? I mean, it is actually we are up against the wall in a way that is like potentially scary.
Why do you think no Democrat raised that in the issue in the hearing?
I don't know. I think this is like personally, I don't know why we are filling this position right now. It just seems like a big mistake. Like there are just not enough safeguards in place right now. The guardrails are too thin. There are not enough people.
All right. Let's move on. Before we get to our next topic, Slate Plus members you get the lucky chance to hear us talk about the terrifying climate change article that appeared in New York Magazine, and whether that was a fruitful and valuable piece of journalism. Is it good to scare people in order to get them to do things about climate change or not? If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. This week marks the 87th coming of an Obamacare repeal bill. Will it be the last one? The Senate is working furiously this week to revive and pass its BRCA. I can't even remember what that stands for. Do you guys remember?
Better Care Reform Act?
BCRA, maybe. Nice.
BRCA.
BRCA.
Oh, but that makes no, better, no, it doesn't work.
I think it's BICRA.
BICRA. You're right. BICRA. I'm sorry. So BICRA. Maybe I was right.
Bikram yoga. There we go. Nicely done. Well, the
teamwork.
I think
that's wrong. I think Better Care is right and the rest is probably wrong.
No, there's an RA. There's definitely an RA. Like every freshman dorm, it has an RA. The senators have returned from their July 4th recess, where many of them caught hell from constituents about support for the previous version of BICRA. According to one poll I saw, support for a senator dropped 30% when the polled E was told that the senator supported a bill.
Which senator? That's
no, weird. In general.
Oh, like, in general, yeah. Like the generic senator. Yeah. That's excellent.
They are attempting one more rewrite. I think it has been revealed today, although I haven't seen it as we're taping, but it's expected to contain Medicaid cuts will basically remain. There will be some sweeteners. Some of the taxes won't.
More funding for opioid abuse treatment.
And it, I think, I don't know, John, maybe you know the answer on this. It's expected to contain Ted Cruz's Freedom Amendment, a two-track healthcare scheme that most experts say would be absolutely catastrophic for people with pre-existing conditions. It's like the death spiral.
Brought to life.
Death spiral insurance plan.
I think that is will be well. It depends on how
they were going to score it with and without, right?
Right, and also they've got to put that out there to try to for either face saving reasons or it's hard to see how you if that becomes a part of this how you don't lose your moderates.
Because, but if you don't try it, then you never get Cruz Lee and maybe Paul. Though Paul seems like he's not going to vote anyway.
Exactly, and you also need to people like Ted Cruz. You need to say if you're a Republican leader. We gave you all the room you could run. You know, you had a chance to convince your colleagues. You had a chance to make this case that this is a failure of getting 50 votes, not a failure of trying because, you know, Senate leadership is weak and aren't true conservatives. So it'll be in there, but it won't. I don't think it's going to go very far.
But the amendment won't go very far, or the bill's not going to go very far?
Well, I guess both. The amendment and then the bill, because if it falls off, there I don't see what gets Cruz and Lee on. And I mean, Lee has basically said if it's not a part of the bill that he won't vote for it. So that's
and,
one.
I mean, Heller and Collins, to my surprise, seem to actually holding their ground against voting for the bill. And Rand Paul said he wasn't voting for it either. That's three. I mean, maybe that's silly and they'll move, but I've been impressed, actually, at the things all three of them have said will make it hard to shift to change gears at this point.
So, John, is it? Do you think it's going to get to a vote? Do you think? I mean, did do you think McConnell has a plan to get it passed?
I don't see how it passes. I don't see because of this problem, which has been baked in the cake since the minute they started trying to deal with healthcare, which is you just have two irreconcilable positions. And if you do anything to, I mean, the bill or the amendment that Cruz and Lee are putting forward, which if people haven't been following this, it essentially allows insurance companies to not have to listen to any of the Obamacare mandates as long as there's one plan in a state that would contain those mandates. The problem, of course, is that all the sick people go into the Obamacare plan, the premiums go through the roof, they aren't able to pay them, so that while you may be able in theory to say that pre-existing conditions are covered, quote-unquote covered, the plans in which the plan, the vestigial Obamacare plan that's left that has all the mandates that are a part of the Affordable Care Act, it's so expensive that it only covers it in name only, but not actually in a way that actual sick people could get covered. And that's something that Republican leadership doesn't like. It's not just the so-called moderates who don't like it.
I mean, the other thing that keeps striking me about all the sausage making is that it's so ideological in nature. So the only argument that's coherent that I hear for what you just described is like we're unleashing the power of the free market, except like, first of all, there is no such thing as like a quote abstract free market. Markets are constructed. They depend on how you construct them. But also it's like this fantasy. That is not how the provision of healthcare has worked. And as I understand it, there are a couple of states that tried to create these separate pools and it was a total bomb. There's something deeply anti-pragmatic about all of this that makes it very hard for me to take it seriously.
Right. Well, the risk pools can work if you dump a whole mountain of money on the risk pools.
So I thought Republicans didn't like to dump mountains of money on people.
So the way it could work is you set up this vestigial Obamacare plan and then you say the premiums will be this percentage of your income, no matter what your income, because you shouldn't be penalized if you just happen to be a wealthy person who's sick and has pre-existing conditions. I mean, you shouldn't in a society that decides that they want to help people who have pre-existing conditions have access to healthcare regardless of income. Anyway, that it would be a percentage of your income and that would slide with healthcare inflation. I mean, that's a way you could pad that vestigial Obamacare plan, essentially making it a funded risk pool. The problem is you would then be hooking up the federal government to a huge and expensive thing that I don't think any Republican would be excited to do. And unless you have guarantees that are kind of baked into a formula, a person wouldn't be able to vote for that in good conscience because they would know that unless there's a formula that grows with healthcare inflation, it's not going to grow fast enough to actually take care of these people.
And there's actually even a flip side problem of the whole thing, which is that the light plans that Cruz would allow wouldn't have to cover chemotherapy, pregnancy, hospitalization, prescription medicine. So you'd have this whole situation of people who
– gaming.
Who – like are going to take a risk and say like, I'm not going to get any of these things. And so I can pay these cheap plans. But then when they do, there's this whole other problem of like, how are those people going to be covered for the things which all of us end up having to pay for?
To give this more of its due, it is true that our existing Obamacare system asks healthy people to subsidize sick people.
That's what an insurance pool is.
I totally understand. But you were really going to solve for that problem, you would move towards something like a Medicaid or Medicare buy-in or single payer, except that you believe that any kind of government involvement in the provision of health insurance is anathema and socialism and is going to destroy the country, right? It's like only if you're trying to separate out not blend the risk pool in this way that makes insurance fail and you deeply oppose government involvement in providing health insurance that you get to this answer.
One of the things that's been interesting is that senators from rural states or states that have a lot of rural hospitals have been worried about what this bill will do, Republican senators. And this, again, is another surprising – I mean, the president, who has been essentially absent from this debate, which is amazing, again, when you think about it, his skill in the private world was as a marketer, both as
a
politician.
And a dealmaker, don't forget.
You know, he turned in from being a real estate guy to being a guy who sold basically his name to being a TV guy. Like, he knows how to market stuff in his previous life. And the marketing of this has not shown the fruits of his expertise. But also in the bill itself, the forgotten man who the president campaigned for, the reason these senators are worried about rural areas is because they get hit. And that's the part of the Trump coalition. So how the Trump coalition can get this far down the line and still be in jeopardy by a bill being put together in the era of President Trump is a failure of execution, if nothing else, and kind of amazing. And then one other thing we should note is there's an obvious tactical reason for the way that Mitch McConnell is doing this, which is through reconciliation, which only requires a majority of Republican votes. But as Ezra Klein wrote, I mean, this is a total backwards way that you're supposed to do legislation. We shouldn't forget in the shifting standards of our times that normally what you're supposed to do is get, go through a committee, both sides get their say. And it gets worked out.
Could have in a the, hearing or two.
In the process. Mm. And this process is not the normal way of going about
Well, there's this bizarro thing where McConnell threatens that Republicans might have to work with Democrats to stabilize the healthcare markets if they can't pass this bill. I mean, it's like, oh, my God, if we can't do this by pushing it through all our own, we might have to go through a normal legislative process with the other people who are in the legislature with us. Shocking.
Some fear that somehow they're going to pass this.
Is if it fails, John, is this, first of all, do Republicans continue, do they own Obamacare or do Democrats own it? And is this healthcare just like now done until that we have some massive other change where there's a veto-proof, filibuster-proof majority for people somewhere?
Well, there are some competing pressures. There's the tax scorekeeping pressure that you need. It makes tax reform easier if you can cut some of the taxes as a part of the Affordable Care Act. So there's that reason that you would, it will make tax reform more difficult. Secondly, some of the money in the Republican Party, the Koch network, maybe primarily, has said, we're either going to turn off the money to you for 2018 or we're going to be very stingy because you haven't delivered. You haven't delivered on tax reform and you haven't delivered on repealing the Affordable Care Act. So if it doesn't pass, there will be those penalties. And it's that pressure that may very well get some people to act when it may look like it's in a perilous state right now.
The Forgotten Man or the Koch brothers, who would you choose?
And then the president told Pat Robertson in an interview on Wednesday night that he would be very angry, and he just kind of stepped back away from it. But it seemed like he, of course, he's declared before that he was going to move on. Remember, after the first House bill died, he said he was going to move on, not going to do health care, going to go right to taxes. And obviously, they went back at it and were able to pass it. So I think it's hard to know what's really going to happen until the thing it collapses, if in fact it does.
My view is like, if they can't get this bill passed now, they're just basically going to abandon health care reform for some indefinite future.
I just don't know how they can do that. I mean, I think
the box for tax reform.
I think the box for future tax cuts they want to pass as a part of tax reform. But then I think, yeah. And then I think also just like there's a not delivering on your promise of 7 years. That's what's motivating a lot of this behavior. So that doesn't go away, even if they don't pass it. And that energy still continues to kind of knock on the door. There's going to have to be a response to that. And I don't think the response will be to do nothing. But I can't predict what
could
the response is.
Could you still do big tax cuts with that 10-year sunset provision like they did the last time?
Right. The problem with that, yeah, it's not the preferred way to go, which is you do tax cuts that all disappear after 10 years so that you can fulfill the budget requirements. But the problem is that it doesn't lead to the kind of wholesale reform that their supporters want and that they want, because it's so temporary, people can't kind of plan.
Oh, things are rat fuck. Sorry, pardon my French. Emily, do you think there's going to be a bill that's passed?
I guess that I bet against it, but I think that this whole, all of the dynamics that John was just describing lead me to think that it's not dead and that it's possible. That's like, I can't see the votes for it, but I also don't think the politics of not passing it are acceptable for the Republican Party.
Well, but it's not the Republican Party. It's sort of,
are there 51 senators? Yeah. Right. When I mean, try
Susan
to count,
I don't feel like Susan Collins cares about that issue. Susan right. Collins doesn't.
Agreed.
Doesn't care about.
She doesn't
like,
care about the reform
goals,
repeal.
Like, we promised. She,
you know, oh, right.
The Koch
She'll
brothers.
Be okay.
Like she's planning to run for governor. It right. seems like. Yeah, I agree with you. And I also have been surprised. I thought Dean Heller was going to start to cave fast, and he really hasn't. And the other thing is these Republican governors who are trying to stand there and support some of these senators, they haven't moved either. I mean, it also is just from the point of view of like the impact they're going to have on people's lives, the potential upheaval, the polling on how much people disapprove, how scared people are of this kind of change. Like there are a lot of reasons against it. So, yeah.
If you liked that conversation about the healthcare fight, you're going to love Trump Care, Slate's podcast about the fight over healthcare reform. 3 times a week, Slate reporters Jim Newell and Jordan Weissman discuss the latest twists and turns in the bizarre legislative saga, and they update listeners on how worried they should be about the future of healthcare. Download and subscribe at slate.com/Trump Care.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest, biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
In a cover story in the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, this town melts down. Mark Leibovich, the chief national correspondent of the magazine, a colleague of Emily's, we should note, paints a portrait of Washington in the Trump era. Mark, of course, is the author of the mega bestseller. What year was that, Mark? What was
it? It was 2013.
2013 mega bestseller, This Town, which is a chronicle of life in what he called Suck Up City. And so he's gone and updated it. He tries to show how a city that runs on chyrons and proximity to power and greed has changed in the Trumpish era. So, Mark, what's the basic thesis of how Washington has changed?
The basic thesis is, well, first of all, I wanted to look at whether, I mean, just to what degree the swamp has been drained. And I guess the conclusion was the swamp is more, it's more like a gold-plated hot tub at this point. You have all of the qualities of Washington that I tried to write about a few years ago, the incestuousness, the sort of creeping obsession of celebrity, the fixation on money, the wealth, the self-dealing has been in a way exacerbated. And I think the real wild card now is that access to power and influencing the White House and influencing the president has been mediated through the completely capricious and random whims of Donald Trump.
Super. Sounds great. Gold-plated hot tub. Where can the rest of us sign up? So what are the implications of this? I mean, it makes a huge difference for the kind of power class in Washington that things have become unstable and mercurial. Does it matter in terms of the government and policy and the lives of people who do not live inside the Beltway?
So far, it hasn't, because nothing has gotten done. I mean, you have these parallel universes playing out where you have all of the mishigas of the White House and all of the news cycle that is generated around that with what is going on in Capitol Hill, which is its own flavor of dysfunction. And obviously there's a symbiosis between what the president's agenda is and what the congressional agenda is. And I mean, you have just sort of two flavors of dysfunction kind of merging right now in this summer of incredible discontent, overlaid by this just frenzied news cycle that I think is just messing with everyone.
You do in the new swampland, though, you do have, when things don't get done, that's actually helping somebody. So, for example, when you have regulations removed as a part of the Congressional Review Act, or you have the FDA, the FCC, the EPA, all not doing the kinds of active things they would have done before, that helps certain industries. All of those industries have inroads into the administration. And in fact, for a president who campaigned against having lobbyists or big donors in his administration, it's full of them.
Oh, absolutely.
And who campaigned on term limits, has never talked about it. I mean, the swamp draining agenda as articulated by the president and that you beautifully in the piece write about with Corey Lewandowski, the swamp draining agenda has A, not been achieved. And then, as you say, what it's been replaced by is the same kind of system where the people are not represented, but the interests of those in power create a class and a club that then people have entry to and spend their time trying to maintain entrance in that club or membership in that club.
Yes, it's true. I mean, Corey Lewandowski is the perfect example here. I mean, Corey Lewandowski is someone who has no cachet in government, no Washington experience at all. I mean, his career is basically grounded in having been a kind of journeyman Republican operative. He latches on to Donald Trump early on, becomes his campaign manager. He gets bounced from the campaign, I guess, about a year ago. Disgraced, but not really disgraced, because he still talks to Donald Trump. Trump out of nowhere wins. And all of a sudden, Corey Lewandowski decides that instead of going in to the White House, I'm not even sure he had the opportunity to do so, he can now be this extremely well-paid and catered to power broker who these corporations are just lining up to pay because he can get the president on the phone. There's this anecdote in the story where Corey is holding court in the middle of the Trump Hotel, which is kind of the radiant epicenter of this new swamp. And Anthony Scaramucci, who is another great kind of Trump-era character.
And has the best name
ever.
Has
a great name. He's known as the Mooch. He is known as the Mooch. He goes back, he said to his 9-year-old Little League team, the Mooch I can't even the mooch is just perfect. So the mooch comes over. He says to Corey, "Corey, I just want to thank you for that thing you did at the White House today." He thanks Corey like three times for like in four times in 5 minutes for like doing him a solid. And it turns out what Corey did was he talked to the president or someone, I assume it was the president, to get the mooch a job in the administration, which was some ambassadorship to the European Economic
– the OECD.
Something. It's based in Paris. It's got a really plum place.
Paris,
really,
a nice place.
Nice place. There was some problem getting him his initial job, which was the head of the White House liaison office due to his sale of his company. And subsequent to that nomination, he has to be Senate confirmed. He was named, I think, head of the Export-Import Bank, which Trump during the campaign called excess baggage.
But is now okay with.
I said in the story.
You had a great line about this.
Claim.
Yeah. Exactly.
The OECD always sounds to me like something you're going to see one of those prescriptions on TV for. You know, if you have OECD.
The prescription is a large, beautiful home in Paris.
Right. Which can cure most ailments.
Absolutely.
So one thing I noticed, Mark, about this piece is that there are basically no Democrats in it. You have great scenes. There's an incredible scene of Trump sitting alone in his office watching a re-airing of Fox and
Hoping
Friends.
That you'll come in and talk to him to relieve his boredom, even though you had no appointment and no plan
although
to speak
it might
to
have
the
been
president
staged.
Of the United States.
That whole thing might have been staged.
Do you think if you were but staging something, you'd stage like, yourself sitting alone watching Fox and
for
Friends?
What? For the benefit of who?
On repeat?
Well, this is interesting. I mean, there's like many levels of self-parody and parody going on with what I'm about to say, but POTUS is watching a tape of Fox and Friends, which was on 4 hours earlier. Apparently, he missed it. 12:30 in the afternoon. He was not eating lunch, but he was watching Fox and Friends in this little conference area right off the Oval. And here's where the meta self-parody comes in. So I told this story on Morning Joe yesterday. And the president, like about within the next hour, tweeted something about how
I'm not watching
too much TV. Because I guess in the course of this conversation, someone remarked about how he watches TV all the time. And yeah, so the layers here are fun. I mean, I think there's part of me that thinks sometimes that the president is on so many levels above us as far as like humor genius. I mean, his God, look at the faces around the table.
Waiting for the second half of this sentence.
The levels of self-parody and
oh, you think it's intentional?
No, I don't think it's intentional.
Well, that's why.
But that, what I just said, I think is funny.
It's funny, but it's unintentionally funny.
But you know,
also, I still feel like we're all, this is like fiddling while Rome burns. I mean, Rome's not burning because there is no huge crisis. And I think also what John was pointing out are these like hidden ways in which swampland actually has enormous influence on the rest of the country. And it's just, this is what happens kind of beneath the surface that we don't see.
The president ran to drain the swamp and fight for the forgotten man. And what you don't see
– and build a wall and lock her up.
That's true. What you don't see in your piece or in any other piece is anybody saying we have these meetings and we can't get anything done because the president keeps saying those people who come to my rallies and who stare up at me and who have put all of their hopes and dreams about the country are not being done right by what you're doing. And you've got to make sure X and Y and Z. The whole idea of the swamp is that it's a club everybody protects themselves in and it encases them so they don't have to worry about the forgotten man. That's the whole critique of the inaugural address. And you never hear a single anecdote where they say he is just obsessed with delivering for the common man.
You're absolutely right. And I actually, as a critique, if you want to be sort of clinically political about this. I mean, messaging has been such a weak spot because you could say that about everything. He doesn't play that card virtually at all. But I mean, I think – but what's interesting too is the swamp – I mean, hundreds of millions and billions of dollars have been spent for decades to make things not happen. I mean, industries pay for things not to happen. They pay for there not to be an immigration bill. They pay for not to be – or they pay
– no cleaning up the streams
cleaning up
rule.
The exactly. And the same sort of dynamic of things not getting done is just being, I guess, channeled to a different set of influence-peddling characters.
Mark, one thing that you're really good at is you're really good at the theater criticism of Washington and sort of as a spectacle. And one of the things that's striking about – this article versus the book that you wrote, it's kind of joyless. Like that you, I think you see, you know, that a lot of the patterns are the same as they were, but it really feels like there's not a lot of the kind of glee and spirit and sprezzatura that you found 5 years ago. Do you think it's...
That's a great point.
Do you think that's true?
I do. I think it's extremely joyless.
And is that because these people don't understand Washington and aren't reveling in their takeover of it because it's not working the way they want it to? So
there's a small core of kind of ragtaggy characters in the White House and in the Corey world. But for the most part, I think a lot of the joylessness is that most people of both parties intuitively know that this is not right and it's not normal. Norms are being exploded in ways that might not return to anything we've ever become accustomed to. And I think that's really sad. And what's weird is that that coexists with what is incredible wealth and incredible prosperity and a bizarrely, you know, just a cooking bull market. So you walk around here and there's this feeling of incredible just like prosperity. And yet there's this mood of joylessness, which I think is a good word.
And you capture that in the great conversation you had with Congressman Rooney, and also then in portraying Paul Ryan as well, which is the people who are attached to but not of the White House.
Yeah. I mean, there is this yawning gap, and this is sort of a larger philosophical discussion, but the yawning gap between what Republicans on the Hill especially say publicly and privately about this administration and this president. I mean, I think privately most of them are appalled. Publicly, they are too either, you know, politic or cowardly, whatever you want to say anything like that publicly, because they have this shared agenda and they're scared and they're politicians.
And they don't want to face primary challenges, and the base is still with Trump.
Absolutely. It's all true. The fact is most of them know better. I mean, Sean Spicer, who's the kind of the lead character in this, knows better. I mean, he was a denizen of the swamp. He knows what a norm is. He lived according to norms, and he sort of tried to become a crossover figure where he can now put his feet in the other camp and, you know, leverage whatever, you know, whatever notoriety he has to like a new career and a new brand for himself.
This is the problem with it. The exploding of norms would be great and fine, and your first book or first book in this series, I'm already assuming this is a second volume.
Yes, seriously.
You never know.
Was someday kind of screaming out for an exploding of those norms, because in your book, the norms were keeping everybody padded and safe and happy. And so it was almost a call for people to come in and blow things up. So that part is great.
That's fine.
But the that's really the preparatory remarks for the second part, which is, to what end? For what purpose? So you come in, you disrupt, great. But disruption, the Uber still has to arrive when there's disruption. In other words, Uber was this disrupting force, but it was a disrupting force in which people got a ride to a place faster and more conveniently than before. If it's just putting everybody out of business and the car never arrives, it's not disruption, it's chaos.
I think that you are using the word norms in a funny way. I'm going to be overly sensitive because I wrote a language piece about norms this week, in which I was arguing that norms are as important as law for the functioning of democracy. And the reason is we can't codify everything. So I feel like you're talking about the padding and the swamp as the only kind of norm that exists in Washington, or the kind that it's great to disrupt. But actually, the thing about norms is that they are also key democratic values. And yes, like some of them entrench power and are bad, and we can complain about them. But the notion that you get rid of everything that isn't a written down law, and then you change the bar so that it's only if you break a law that you've done, that is like this weird world we're living in. It doesn't make any sense. Like Uber arriving is also a norm, right?
So, but there's no way as the person who's constantly talking about standards and no, of course all norms can't be blown up. That would be crazy. So no, I'm just talking about the things that were norms that protected people in their comfortableness, not that made life better, that protected democratic institutions, that caused people to treat each other like humans and not judge motives instantly, and all of those other important norms that are part of civilized society. In this specific case, though, I'm talking about the norms that were in Mark's book and that are right to be exploded. I mean, norms are not universally wonderful.
The wrong norms have been exploded.
I'm just going to make my 10-second stance for, I thought actually this town, I thought people overread this town as being like, what a horror show. My view is like, that's fine. Like, it's good that people have social commerce with other people who are ideologically opposed. It's good that people are cutting backroom deals. Like, if we had more of that, if we had more of this town, the functioning of government would be even better.
But you always romanticize this. Like, there is also a problem with that. So when you look at the political science literature on this from, like, 50 years ago, when people were studying the folkways of the Senate or Southern politics, there's, like, a big 1949 book on informal back channeling in Southern politics, it also can, of course, like, I mean, this maybe this is like too obvious to even say, but it can just entrench the already powerful, make it so that one faction continues to have domination long after its utility and keep other people out. And that's like related to the kinds of norms that John's talking about exploding.
I think if you were to sort of look at the norms we would have been talking about circa 4 years ago, if I could sort of like have you retroactively, utopianly, how's that for a couple of qualifiers? Put like a couple of like radical norm shattering things at that period. It would have been some kind of radical lobbying reform or anti-lobbying reform. I mean, I guess you could have a conversation about term limits, so that's sort of a different category. Some kind of radical campaign finance reform. I mean, there are actually prescriptions.
And what you're really talking about is the influence of money,
the influence of money, the revolving door. I mean, these are all things Obama paid lip service to in 08, never really took. And he kept having all these waivers and exceptions, and he didn't do much.
And that's a problem, right? Because then the Democrats are not pure. Yeah. But we've now moved, like, radically, to borrow your word, in another direction in which, like, conflict of interest norms for the president and his family, which we never thought we had to write down in a law because it just seemed really obvious. You wouldn't do this stuff now are being like broken every single day.
Also, but what the president and what his supporters in many cases are doing is they are trying to excuse a lot of his really, I think, outside the lines behavior as just, you know, the kind of norm shattering that he ran on and that he was elected on. And I think that's
right.
Potentially really dangerous.
Also, I think the distinction, David, what there's a distinction between what you're talking about and I think what Mark originally wrote about, which is there's a distinction between the systems that grease the skids and harness self-interest, but harness it within boundaries because everybody's self-interested. So you need some dealing that will make legislation happen. That's a perhaps defensible case, which you've made before and which we've talked about on here. But I think what Mark was writing about is the system that allows self-dealing purely for the self-interest of the person involved, where there are no boundaries set up by the system that was supposed to keep people's self-interest kind of within the guardrails, but that they're totally gone so that you can operate in a city and look like you're engaged in productive behavior when the only thing you are producing is more comfort for yourself and your friends.
Right. I mean, I would say, too, I mean, again, I hate to go back to Corey Lewandowski, but there is this – first time I saw him after the election was at the Super Bowl. Okay, I was at the Super Bowl for this book I was working on, and it was a VIP pregame reception, and who should show up in shorts? And there's all these owners and like Mahers around, and Corey shows up in shorts, and I said, what are you doing here? He goes, oh, I'm a guest of Microsoft. And so – you know, Microsoft, I guess one of his clients, has just decided to send him a ticket to the Super Bowl, and he's down in Houston living it up. And I mean, I don't know
life
who else.
Of a lobbyist.
I don't know who else Microsoft sent to the game, but you know, 4 years ago, you probably would have seen, you know, a lot of better dressed, more established former Hill people. I don't know. I mean, it's just a new flavor of swampiness again, mixing metaphors.
Is there anything?
Now with more swampiness.
Wait. All right. So, what closing thoughts do you guys have on norms?
One point I would like to make is that I haven't read Emily's story yet, but I think that there needs to be a story on norms that only quotes people named Norm, like Norm Ornstein.
So when I was Googling to work on this story, you know, of course, I started out, I was just like, norms, Trump. No, doesn't work. Norma, Norm, someone
because
or other.
Norm Ornstein problem. Himself is like in someone who actually is an authority on norms. I mean, this is...
And Norm Eisen shows up in this. There's
correct.
A lot of
right.
norms who have something to say
Absolutely.
About norms.
And it does call out for at least four different words for the norms that Emily wants to protect, the norms that Mark's first book was about, what David was talking about, and I feel like there's a fourth category here.
The proper name.
Yeah.
We should
the
have
bedrock an bedrock values of democracy. That's what I really
Here's
should
what
have
right.
We should have an award show
from the town of
in
bedrock.
Which the people who are the best at either shattering or perpetuating or improving norms are recognized, and Norm MacDonald could host it or something, or anyone
else. He came up too in my Googling.
Mm. Really? I should hope so. Although Norm MacDonald is a phenomenal, everyone should go watch the ESPYs that he hosted in 1997 with some of the most offensive, horrific lines ever, which are kind of funny.
We are so
off the cuff.
I don't even know Norm MacDonald is.
We're talking about Norm.
Norm! Cheers. All right. But there was no actual substantive point you wanted to, additional substantive point you wanted to be made and asked?
No, no. I'm more of an entertainer.
Okay.
just read the story. You know,
okay.
Read the book.
All right. Mark Leibovich of the New York Times Magazine, read his story, which I've now forgotten the headline, but between the time we started, this town.
Our town melts down.
This town melts down. This town in the Sunday New York Times Magazine. Thanks for coming by, Mark.
Great to be here, guys.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Let's go to cocktail chatter when we're having dinner this weekend. We can all chatter at each other. What will we be chattering each other about? John, what's your chatter?
My chatter is a double chatter. One, it's about a new book about Chester Arthur, a president everybody makes a lot of fun of, if for no other reason than those extraordinary sideburns he had. But there's a new book out by Scott Greenberger about Chester Arthur, which I have not actually started reading, but looks very good because Chester Arthur was essentially this hack politician, kind of stumbled into the presidency, but then in the office kind of tried to be the better moral character, ends up not even getting his own party's nomination, but fights the machine to put him in. And I've always kind of had this soft spot for Chester Arthur. So I'm intrigued by that new book and the idea of a president thrust into the moment, actually kind of not reclining into the easiest way forward, but actually being pulled by the standards of the job in another direction that they had previously in their career and history not been interested in. So that's one thing. And the other is just a shout out to the Miller Center at UVA, which, having just spent a lot of time with the Johnson tapes for the most recent Whistle Stop, they have done such a fabulous job with presidential recordings, not just the audio, but also all the transcripts. And the great thing about the transcripts is, particularly on the Johnson ones, you can read them and they deliver entertainment just on their own basis. I mean, regardless, you don't need context. They're a joy on their own, but they have this great context with this great little web feature where anytime you come across something like the old – when Johnson refers to the old China lobby, you just click the little plus sign and it gives you like two sentences on what he's talking about so that you can understand why what he's just said is so important. Anyway, they've just done a fabulous job. And so if you're ever bored, go there and just check out any random presidential recording and you will be satisfied.
How many times did you listen to the like barbed wire fence, the Hagar Slacks guy?
I didn't – well, I've listened to that so many times in previous life. But in this one – there were surrounding this Anna Chenault conspiracy to slow down the Paris peace talks. There were a lot of them. And listening to Johnson try to play these, like, calm down Nixon, but also calm down Humphrey, so that his little tiny little peace pause at the end of his presidency will go through. It's just fascinating listening to him. And then at one point he reads, I think it's Richard Russell, a letter from Clark Clifford to him telling him how great he is, which sounded exactly like what some of the cabinet aides said to the president during that strange cabinet meeting where they all praised him for the cameras. The language of Clark Clifford's note to the president was like it just exactly from that press conference. So it's a anyway, all kinds of little random gems in there like that.
Emily, what's your chatter?
I decided to chatter about some good news for a change. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau put a rule into effect this week that is going to push companies out of forced arbitration and back into the courtroom when consumers and employees have access to grind with them. that's kind of amazing that in this administration, this is happening. This is something that corporate America really tried to fight. They don't like these lawsuits, these big class action collective lawsuits in which people get their money back and get their rights vindicated. And the glory for companies of forced arbitration is that basically nobody ever bothers to go through the process and win any real value because you have to do it individually and it's all behind closed doors. And the CFPB is like standing tall in this administration. They did a huge amount of like reporting and research before they put this rule into effect, and it is actually happening. So, you know, there are plenty of people in the Trump administration who have called for defanging the CFPB or shutting it down or getting rid of the head of it, Richard Corder. But so far, it's like doing its thing, and it's kind of amazing.
All right. So my chatter is so frivolous. It's amazing. There was an incredible tweet that went around earlier this week, which has now been elaborated into an article on BuzzFeed. It's from a woman. The tweet was a woman named Shelley Zhang. The tweet was just her text exchange with a friend of hers named Chris Chappelle. And Chris Chappelle had never read the Harry Potter books. And so he was reading. He decided to read them and was reading them. And he had gotten to the fifth book, The Order of the Phoenix. And he was just tweeting to Shelley because he had some questions because he thought that Shelley had told him that the plot took a darker turn in the fifth book. And so he starts to tweet to her about like, wow, it's really surprising that bit where Harry and Hermione are having sex and that part when when Dudley commits suicide by jumping off a building and the part where
she was like, wait a second.
And when Hermione sends Harry, the book starts with Hermione sending Harry a picture of herself in a bikini. And they realize gradually that that he's been reading a fan fiction version of the Harry Potter book.
But the whole time? The or whole, just for the
just for the fifth
Phoenix.
Book. Just for okay. the fifth book.
But he had totally gone
he
for
totally
it.
Totally gone for it.
Sinker. That's awesome.
It is. The text exchange is just so, so funny.
So what does he say when he figures it out?
He's really disappointed.
I like the mentioned version better.
So I guess there's no mention of necrophilia in the real books either. BuzzFeed wrote the whole thing up. It's really great.
That's excellent.
Then he clipped and pasted a bit of the book, which is
David has now completely cracked himself up. Wow. I might have to take this
seen. I don't think I've ever seen David.
I know, she's like lost it.
He cuts and pastes the Harry and Hermione sex scene.
All right, well, David is just hysterically giggling over there. I'm going to use this as an opportunity to recommend a book. Have you ever heard of Fangirl by Rainbow Rowell? There are these two books about writing fan fiction for a series that's like basically a takeoff on Harry Potter. They're really good.
Anyway, that's
we have to get David CPR.
I know, exactly. Sorry. How are you going to get out of the studio?
My nose is all stuffed up.
He's having a complete collapse.
Oh, God.
That's all great. Right.
That's a show for today. For the Blog of Gabfest, it's produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our intern is Kevin Townsend. Leave us a rating in Apple Podcasts. It really helps us. We can rise in the rankings and reach more people, get more attention. Please go rate us in Apple Podcasts. We need it. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We will talk to you next week. I think we'll be together again next week. One more time, hopefully.
Yeah.
Inshallah.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.